Radhika Jones, editor-in-chief of Vanity Fair. If you enjoy binge-watching the best TV shows and love hearing from the actors and showrunners who make them happen, then subscribe to Vanity Fair. Our Hollywood reporters take you behind the scenes of the year's most anticipated projects, the industry's biggest moves, and the hardest-fought awards races. From The Crown to The Real Housewives, we've got the inside scoop. As a special thank you to our still-watching audience, we're offering 15% off a yearly digital subscription to Vanity Fair. Visit vanityfair.com today and use promo code POD15. That's vanityfair.com, promo code POD15 for 15% off a yearly digital subscription to everything you want.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive. Most of you aren't just listening right now. You're driving, cleaning, and even exercising. But what if you could be saving money by switching to Progressive? Drivers who save by switching save nearly $750 on average, and auto customers qualify for an average of 7 discounts. Multitask right now. Quote today at Progressive.com. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $744 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2022 and May 2023. Potential savings will vary. Discounts not available in all states and situations.
AI is making waves in every field it touches. President Biden is now on TikTok, and the election draws closer each day. With so much going on in the world, it is hard to keep up with it all, let me tell you. Hi, I'm Kai Ryssdal, the co-host of Make Me Smart. It's a podcast from Marketplace. And every weekday, Kimberly Adams and I break down the latest in business and the economy with short daily episodes to make it easy for you to stay in the know. Listen to Make Me Smart wherever you get your podcasts.
Is the world more peaceful since the revolution? It is a shame that your people suffered. But bounty hunting is a complicated profession.
Hello and welcome back to Still Watching The Mandalorian. I'm Vanity Fair senior writer Joanna Robinson.
And I'm fellow writer Anthony Bresnikan.
We are here to talk about the Disney Plus series The Mandalorian. This is a podcast where every week Anthony and I check in with each other about the latest episode. This week we are talking about Chapter 2, which is titled The Child. And we will be spoiling nothing beyond Chapter 2, The Child. But make sure you've watched up through Chapter 2, The Child, before you dive into this podcast, because we will be talking all about the plot and everything that happens.
The very title, The Child, is a spoiler. So there you go.
It's true.
For episode 1, or chapter 1.
As we're recording this, the title is currently not on the Wikipedia for The Mandalorian, because it is a secret. So there you go. Mm-hmm. But we can say it, because we have seen it. This episode was written by Jon Favreau and directed by Rick Famuyiwa, and it takes place on a mysterious desert planet, but we have some thoughts and suspicions about what planet it could be. It could possibly be. And the plot is pretty simple. You know, the Mandalorian has acquired the titular child, who he calls the kid. So, I mean, Anthony called this little being a Shamrock Shake last week, and I really liked that, but it looks like in universe they're kind of calling it the kid.
The kid.
So yeah.
It was just something about the fresh, spongy texture of this baby Yoda's skin had that minty milkshake look about him, and you know, the little fuzzy hair, because the hair is kind of, it still looks like little old man hair, but it's like white and curly.
Yeah.
So he just looked like a little frog, a little bit of whipped cream on top. So. I still think of him as a Shamrock Shake.
Okay. You know, so the Mandalorian has this child, this bounty, this kid, and he's trying to take it back so he can get his reward. And instead, some Jawas have come along and stripped his ship. and he needs to go on a mission for them to get, you know, the pieces of his ship back so he can leave the planet. We'll talk a little bit more in detail about what happens, but that's the plot. It's pretty simple. And what is sort of unfolding, as we're watching The Mandalorian, it seems like there's going to be maybe little adventures of the week, that The Mandalorian's going to go on while, maybe pursuing this overarching story about this particular, minty green, bounty that he has been saddled with.
It's like he has side missions, right? He's got to complete certain tasks in the game to get back to where he's going.
Correct. This episode has some kind of big revelations for such a simple plot, and we'll get to all of that as well. But first, before we get into all of that, we want to read some of your emails. So we're going to read some emails. We're going to talk about that. We're going to talk about the plot. And then, Anthony, who do we have as an interview on this podcast this week?
We have the man with no name himself, Pedro Pascal.
Pedro is here. I mean, he was here. We interviewed him a couple weeks ago, but you will hear him talking pretty pertinently about the impact this little green thing has on the Mandalorian. Mm-hmm. and what that could how it could change the course of this person's life. So you know, no spoilers once again beyond this episode, but we will be speaking with Pedro at the end of this episode. So stay tuned for that.
And thanks to him for the trust in letting us pick his brain a little about the being, the child, and, you know, trusting that we wouldn't spoil that in advance. But now's the time to talk. So we're going to have Pedro opening up about it.
We also got a bunch of emails from you guys, as I mentioned. Thank you guys for, we got so many emails. Thank you guys for all of your emails. We really appreciate it. If you want to email us, stillwatchingpod@gmail.com. If you've got questions, comments, corrections, I think I said something wrong. It was my turn this week, but
oh, no.
I don't remember what it was. So if that correction occurs to me, I will let you guys know what I said wrong, but I forget it right now. We're going to start with this email from Suma. Suma wrote in, thanks for the great podcast. In the scene as the Mandalorian is entering, this is about episode one. In the scene as the Mandalorian is entering the armorer's workshop, on the wall above the archway, there is a metallic object that looks a lot like a stylized General Grievous head. What's this about? Dying to know. Before we get into the answer, Anthony, do you want to tell people who don't know who General Grievous is in the first place?
Yeah, General Grievous was a character from the prequel trilogy, turned up in Revenge of the Sith, right?
Yes.
And he was an alien who clearly had been through a lot of battle damage, but had he had a terrible hacking cough. General Grievous. And I think his lungs had been burned or something, but he was sort of a foreshadowing of what Anakin Skywalker would become, this organic being kept alive by mechanics. And so he was known as a Jedi Slayer, kind of a badass from the end of the prequel trilogy. You know, he had four arms and he had a whole bunch of lightsabers. So he would pop out with four lightsabers at once and go whirling around until he met his end. But he did have a kind of weird metallic skull-like mask over, you know, we never really saw the soft little alien wounded inside, but he wore this sort of mask, helmet, life support system, and, you know, the reader is incorrect. It's not General Grievous's face or mask.
Looking at General Grievous, you can see where, you know, this listener got the idea. Absolutely.
But not a bad comparison. It's actually something different.
Yeah. If you go ahead and Google Mythosaur, which gets a mention in episode one, when Nick Nolte's, character, you know, is chiding the Mandalorian for not riding a blurg. And he's like, your people once rode the great Mythosaur, you know, so mm-hmm. It's a Mythosaur skull, hanging above the armorer's shop, not General Grievous.
And Mythosaurs are kind of like galactic dragons, really. They have the same place in Game of Thrones mythology. I know now we're entering your territory here.
So, oh, yes, yes.
You know, where they don't really seem to be around. Just the name itself, Mythosaur, like implies something that once was or maybe is a legend. But you'll notice the Mandalorians have this thing on a lot of their pennants and flags. This is the mark of their tribe.
So that is what is going on there. It's sort of a, hey, you're entering a Mandalorian sort of structure here.
Yeah. Do you think am I making a good comparison there? Like the Mythosaur is to Mandalorians what dragons are to Targaryens?
Well, dragons, yeah, and what dragons were, especially before they came back, right? Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? This sort of like, did they ever really exist? We don't know. How big were they? We don't know, sort of thing. So, I mean, it's in the title, Mythosaur, you know, that's what it is. So anyway, that was a good question, but not, what we're looking for, but, we did get an email from Monica who writes in about, droids, why the Mandalorian hates droids. We were talking about that. The Mandalorian is obviously a bit prejudiced and bigoted towards droids. I speculated the droids are stealing everyone's jobs, but, Monica has a better answer. She writes, you both mentioned in passing that you weren't sure why the Mandalorian expresses a clear prejudice against droids more than once in the series premiere. And I was curious about the same thing. Based on the timeline, is it possible that he grew up during the Clone Wars? In the flashback in episode 1, which I think we're assuming is him as a child with his parents, there are super battle droids in the background.
That's correct.
Yes. Could his parents have been killed by an army of droids, leaving him with a massive droid-related trauma and prejudice? It seems plausible. I'd love to hear your thoughts. Racism against droids has been a prominent recurring theme in Star Wars, i.e. we don't serve their kind here. And with the discussion about class disparity... And the discussion about class disparity in Solo with L337 as a woke droid. I'm interested in how they're going to continue to tell that story in The Mandalorian. Thank you so much for the podcast and for your time. So yeah, that's a really good point that Monica makes, that in this purge event, which we still don't know the full story of, you definitely see these droids in the background carrying out the work of the Empire, we can presume. So... yeah, that's enough to give someone a prejudice, I suppose, right?
I guess, and we do see that in the flashback. We do see those droids torturing and destroying things, and you can gather why somebody would dislike them. You know,
yes,
every droid
absolutely.
Going forth then is that droid.
Right.
The one that caused grief for your family.
We should mention, so we are recording this on Thursday because we each got to go to, in our respective cities, an event where they showed 3 episodes of The Mandalorian. And before they showed those episodes, and like I said, we're not going to talk about episode 3 yet, but before they showed those 3 episodes, a friend of the pod, Ash Crossan, did a great Q&A with, the cast and directors and Jon Favreau and Dave Filoni. And I just wanted to talk to you really quickly. You got to see it live. I got to see it simulcast. But I just want to talk to you about one moment in particular during that Q&A, if you don't mind.
Yeah, and I'm so glad you gave a shout out to Ash. She is a friend of this podcast. And I don't know. It's just weird when you have a colleague out there. I hate to say, like, I feel proud of you. Like I did something. Not like but I'm a proud friend of Ash's and her work, and to see her moderate not just this panel last night, but the one a couple of weeks ago where it was the press event for Mandalorian. She's known as the Porg Queen because she's a real champion of porgs and porg culture. But she now she's like the Mandalorian Queen too.
The Mando Queen. Yeah, to hear Kathy Kennedy say thanks, Ash, I was like, oh, okay. Oh, yeah, she did a great job too. But one exchange in particular that I found both emotionally impactful and interesting is, you know, Ash was asking Bryce Dallas Howard, who directed, an episode later on this season, about her connection to George Lucas, Bryce Dallas Howard being Ron Howard's daughter. You know, Ron Howard worked with George Lucas on the film Willow, which I think we referenced Willow in the first episode in terms of a story about protecting a baby on a journey sort of thing.
For sure.
You know, that Bryce grew up sort of around George Lucas, obviously Ron Howard directed Solo, so sort of what Bryce's connection to George and all of that was. And Bryce talked about it a little bit, but mostly she threw it over to Dave and was talking about some of the stuff that we've been talking about how Dave Filoni is truly this sort of heir to George. And, you know, she says something about how George talked about Dave Filoni and thinking of him as a son, which, you know, and then the camera, you were watching it live, but I was watching it simulcast, and the camera like zoomed in on Dave's face.
Oh, really?
As he was like registering this moment. Yeah, it was a lot that was going on. But, she said something really interesting about, George is passing on the knowledge. And I just thought that that was interesting in terms of maybe some of the things we've talked about, the presence of this Yoda species being, and how George Lucas has in the past said that Lucasfilm could not use that particular race of creature, but that perhaps in this project that is so important to Dave, maybe he's allowing them access to a corner of the universe that he has sort of kept to himself, and he's passing it on to Dave, and allowing Dave to pass it on to all of us, you know? I don't know if I'm like over extrapolating from what Bryce was saying, but that kind of seemed like at least partially an interpretation of what she was saying.
And he, I don't know if we were able to play any of the audio, but then, you know, he talked about how much this meant to him, and he said, I wish my father was here to see this.
Ugh, yeah.
And that really got to me, not just knowing Dave, and, you know, I knew that his father passed away, and but I was sitting with my daughter, who's 10, and she, like, squeezed my hand, and she was like, well, you're here, you know?
Oh,
so, like, that made me feel good.
Oh, wow.
You know, that's to amazing. Take her and see it. You know, that's a big part of what Star Wars is. I know there's a lot of talk about fandom and toxic fandom and what's good fandom and why this means so much and why people geek out so much and in such depth about Star Wars. And I think it's because it is a part of our lives in ways that have deep layers. You know, it's your brother that you watched the original movies with, or your sister that you played with and shared comics with, or your cousin or your uncle or your aunt or your grandma or whoever it was that, like, took you to see these movies and shared them with you and shared the toys and shared the books and shared the stories and played along with you, your best friend, your worst enemy, whatever. it really does become not just a piece of entertainment, but a part of the texture of the lives we lead. And it was amazing too to hear not just that emotional moment from Dave and from Bryce Dallas Howard, but then, you know, Werner Herzog, who's not necessarily like, I mean, a brilliant, fascinating guy, but not the most touchy-feely person, talking about this is the role of mythology in your life. And, you know, you very rarely go back to ancient times. You find something like this, but it's very rare to find in the modern era stories like this with such depth and feeling. And I enjoyed every minute of it. And it's like, okay, even Werner Herzog is geeking out, you know, and he kind of famously gave an interview last week where he was like, I wasn't nervous about working with Jon Favreau. I don't know any of the movies he's made. and yet here he was able to enjoy the fun and the play of Star Wars, while also recognizing what we project onto it. You know, a movie is projected onto a screen, a TV show is projected out from your TV, but there's so much that's projected within us onto these stories. And that's why they mean so much. That was a great conversation.
Absolutely. And it was the other thing that I did want to mention. I agree with everything you said, and I think it was interesting that Werner used the word cinema, because this has become such a charged word around, like, popular entertainment and what is cinema and what is popular entertainment. And Werner is, like, making the case that, you know, this is definitely can be both. Sorry. But another listener, Kathy, sort of in a different channel, not an email, sort of raised this question to me about a lot of us, including a lot of people on that stage, you know, at this Q&A, talk about how Star Wars is part of our childhood, about part of how we grew up, about how exploring the Mandalorian is so fun for those of us who have lived with Star Wars for so long. But her question was like, well, okay, what about people who are new to the fandom? Something that I thought was interesting is, Ash was asking Dave Filoni in that Q&A, you know, what can you basically, you know, what do we need to know about the Mandalorian cultures, or the story of Mandalore, which is explored in the Clone Wars and Rebels, the animated series that Dave Filoni worked on. She's like, what do we need to know? And he was like, nothing. And I think that's so important. He's like, there's no barrier of entry as far as they're concerned for the show. Like, you know, you and I are doing our level best, and people all around the internet who know way more than either of us combined about Star Wars are doing their level best to sort of point out these cool little Easter eggs and references. But, like, I think what is important for the future of Lucasfilm as, you know, what, who they want to be, is they want to be a place that's friendly to newcomers, to new fans. And so I think that they're trying really hard to make a show that you can latch onto. And I think this episode in particular is a really good example of that, where you don't really have to know anything. The story could not be simpler. And in fact, there is so little dialogue in this episode. Mm-hmm. And so it could almost operate as a silent film, you know, and you're just, you get it. You understand there's like this small thing, this person with like no movable features that we can see has to kind of protect it. And then there's like a clear mission, and you don't need to even know what a Jawa is in order to enjoy this episode. So mm-hmm. I think that's worth mentioning and worth remembering as we talk about The Mandalorian. So
I think that accessibility is so important, and you and I know a lot about this universe and all that, but a universe that ceases to grow starts to collapse. And I think, adding people in new ways, and the Mandalorian will be their favorite character, and this world will be an entry point to them, just as Rey is an entry point for some people, and the new trilogy brings folks in, and as much as the prequels are derided, by critics and, you know, fans of the original trilogy, I think they created generations of fans, and you've got to respect that some people like things that you don't and get things that you don't, but they have to speak in a language that can be, recognized and entertaining to people who are unfamiliar with everything that came before, you know?
Right. So, let us talk about this episode specifically, shall we? There's actually one more thing from the premiere that I want to talk about.
What was it?
Yeah, Anthony was like, let's keep this episode short. I'm like, okay, but one more thing.
We're good.
Something that eagle-eyed viewers of the premiere pointed out is that the character of Dr. Pershing, who we meet in the first episode, who's working for the client, right? And he's like, he's the one who's like, please bring this bounty, the Shamrock Shake, the kid, please bring it back alive. Whereas the client, Werner Herzog's character, is like, dead or alive, I don't care, bring it back, you know? So some very, very sharp-eyed folks on the internet looked closely at a character still of the Dr. Pershing character, noticed a patch on his arm. And when I rewatched episode one last night at the screening, I was looking closely. You kind of can't see it in the episode. He's keeping that shoulder away from the camera, but on his right shoulder, there's a patch with an emblem on it, that is worn by all of the clones on the planet Kamino, and I hope I'm pronouncing that correctly, which is like where all the clones were made in the prequel trilogy, right? And so it's like a marker of you are a clone, you have this patch. Is that
it's
correct?
It's like two vertical lines, isn't it?
Yeah. It's like a little I. It's like a little I and an L. That's what it looks like to me. Like the lower a lowercase the Italian article eel, like I L. That's what it looks like to me. But if you watch the prequel trilogy, the little Fett clones all have this patch, are all wearing the same emblem, and so you and I had already talked about the idea that like maybe this little being, this little kid, this Shamrock Shake, is a clone, and maybe it is a clone of Yoda, maybe, or maybe something that they want to clone. But you know, that cloning is somehow perhaps involved in whatever science, Dr. Pershing, is, you know,
whatever he's sciencing.
There.
Yeah. He's, yes. Whatever he's sciencing. There's definitely something there. You know, I think that's fascinating because, you know, we know the Empire has fallen, but what experiments was the Empire up to? And when the Empire collapses, what becomes of that? You know, so it seems like maybe things just kind of broke open. And, I'm kind of curious to see where they're going, whether this means the creature's a clone, whether it's something they want to clone.
Right. And
what that has to do with Rise of Skywalker, too, man.
Ooh, well, yes. It's a good question. And like, someone else pointed out to me that, Dr. Pershing's, costume looks pretty similar to what Galen Erso is wearing in Rogue One. And that just, it's just like a science officer-y, an imperial science officer-y costume. Well, you know what I mean? So, that's, you know.
And it's blue and white, which was the colors of the, what were those long, the Kaminoans? The long-necked, lanky looking alien type creatures.
The cloners.
Similar to the outfits they wore.
So something that you mentioned when we very first talked about Werner Herzog's character, the client, back in our preview episode, was the comparison you made to this character after the Empire's fallen, but still wearing sort of an imperial insignia and being protected by stormtroopers. Is it's like a Nazi who has fled to Argentina,
right?
But is still wearing like Nazi regalia. And I'm like, okay, so are we like expanding that to some sort of, I don't know, eugenics kind of ideal? You know, Nazis were interested in eugenics, the Empire interesting in cloning. That's just, you know, these are all things to keep in our minds as we go forward.
He seems like a warlord on the make. Like, all he's got are these scrappy little stormtroopers right now, but it seems like he's trying to build up something and get a little power back.
Something that I hadn't noticed the first time I watched the episode was that Dr. Pershing, in that first episode, his lips are very, like, dry and chapped. Like, he just doesn't look well, is what I'll say. That, like, I've seen that actor in other things. He's looked healthier in other roles. And so, like, you know, he looks like he's not maybe being treated super well.
That's not his thing. Oh, get us a chapped lip deck. Let's get that guy what looks like he really has got, you know, some windburn going on.
Yeah.
No, he definitely seems like they seem like they're in desperate circumstances. They've been through some things. And what I loved, you know, in the broadcast from the premiere, Herzog said something like, I'm going to misquote, but he said, I knew when they told me that the character was dark and unpleasant and untrustworthy, it would be easy to play. Like, I may be slipping a little more into Arnold Schwarzenegger than Werner Herzog with that, but he definitely is relishing the evilness of the mysterious client. And I have one thing to add that I don't think made it onto the show, onto the presentation, onto the simulcast. Because after they ended it, and they, like, but right before they start the movie, they have to, like, pack up the stage and get the chairs and all that off. And so Dave Filoni and Jon Favreau walked out, and the curtain came down, and they told one additional story about shooting with the animatronic Baby Yoda, the little puppet Shamrock Shake. And they said, you know, they felt pretty confident about the animatronics they had, but they weren't sure how it would read on camera. So they would shoot with the puppet and then shoot a clean plate without the puppet in the basket so that they could maybe create a digital effect later if need be. And that when Werner Herzog saw this, and he's like, why are you not shooting with the puppet, you know? And they're like, explained it, and he goes, you are cowards.
All right. So let us talk about this episode, this little adorable puppet that just gets cuter with every frame. Something very, you know, I had sort of mentioned to you the episode one ends with the shot of the Mandalorian sort of like reaching out and the little tridactyl hand of the little kid reaching out to touch him and the crib floating. And I was like, this bassinet is floating. And I was like, later after we recorded the episode, I was like, oh my God, Anthony, am I so stupid? Was it floating because of the force? And you're like, I just thought it was a space bassinet, and me too. And I think we learned this episode. I mean, the force is definitely a thing in this episode, and we will talk about it. But there's a moment when the kid is in danger, and the Mandalorian makes this like gesture with his arm that sort of moves the bassinet really quickly out of harm's way, which makes me think he has like Bluetooth paired his gauntlet or whatever with the bassinet. So this seems to be like, it's not the kid controlling where the bassinet goes. It's linked to the Mandalorian in some way.
It's a hover. Yeah. It's a hover bassinet.
Yeah.
But
yeah,
we do see a little force power come out of that little.
We see a lot of force power.
Yeah.
So it starts with like one of the first things we see is the Mandalorian trying, you know, it's a very, very, we'll talk about Western influences throughout, but this is a very Western moment, right? The campfire, nighttime campfire, camp out scene. And he's trying to heal himself, you know, with a little, device. And we see this little baby try a couple times to use, you know, we know what the baby's trying to do. It seems like the Mandalorian doesn't. He's just like, oh, out of the bassinet again, back in the bassinet with you sort of thing. I don't think it's like, I don't think it's a don't use the force on me moment. I think it's a, like, I don't understand what you're up to here, what you're trying to do.
It's like, you know? me chasing the cat out of the room, is it? Right, right before we recorded this. You get out. Come on.
Get out of here. Get back in that bassinet.
But what was the little guy trying to do? Because he's reaching out to touch this wound that the Mandalorian has, but do you think he was like gonna heal it?
Yeah, force heal. That's what I think.
Force heal? Is that a thing? Have we ever seen that? I never, like, is it like E.T. where E.T. would touch you and heal you?
Like, you know, never... I just assumed force healing was a thing.
Is it not? I mean, I never saw Yoda do that, right?
Yeah, I guess not. So that's a question for all of you listeners. Is force healing a thing? I mean, if you can move things with your mind, couldn't you like knit flesh back together with your, with the force? Especially that was just a flesh wound, merely just a scratch.
Maybe, but I think that's setting up something in the future, is that we're going to see a character, reach a crisis point, maybe, you know, and be seriously hurt. And just when you think all hope is lost, here comes the human power of a shamrock shake.
Of the shamrock shake! Got to pour a little shake on it.
To rejuvenate you with its minty freshness.
Excellent. Yeah, that's a good point. That is classic storytelling, right? Is seed this moment in early, the potential for force healing, to use it when it really counts later. But we get that payoff even in this episode, right? Later on. But as we mentioned, the Mandalorian heads back to his ship with his bounty, and it has been stripped, and there is a bunch of Jawas there. Jawas, who you may recognize if you have seen A New Hope, the very first Star Wars film, and or Spaceballs. Yeah. But these are, I mean, would you call them a scavenger race sort of thing? You know.
Look, I hate to say it. I always thought they were. I would have said before this, like, scavenger race, nomadic, tribal creatures, whatever they are. I think after watching this, we have to face the unpleasant fact that Jawas are the dirtbags of the galactic universe. These are the dirtbags of Star Wars. They're not just, like, scavengers implies, like, you know, that they're maybe impoverished, but they're, you know.
Is a scavenger.
Yeah,
Ray
is a scavenger. These guys are boosting your car and taking your hubcaps. And, like, this is like coming back to your car and finding a bunch of punk kids have stripped it and are running off with, like, the radio station. Or the radio player and the wheels and the, the steering wheel. And, the Mandalorian gives chase and then vaporizes a pile of them. And, like, you realize you don't feel any sympathy for these little creeps. They're the worst. they're thieves and jackals. And he realizes he can't quite take everything back from them. So he has to strike a bargain. And, Kuiil. Is that how we're pronouncing him?
I love that pronunciation.
Kuiil.
It feels very extra, so I like it. Yeah.
Kuiil, the little Ugnaught voiced by Nick Nolte, who likes to end everything with reminding us everything he says, he reminds us that he says, "I have spoken." And he decides to help the Mandalorian by saying, "I'll, you know, strike a sit down with the Jawas and we'll figure out what we can trade in order to get your gear back and get you off of this planet." And what they want is the little baby. I don't know what they're going to do with it, but they can tell that it has some kind of power and there's something cool about it. And the Mandalorian will not give this up. And and then they decide they want something else.
Right. So they want the egg, as they mentioned a couple times. I want to really quickly zoom back and just say quickly, first of all, it appears as though the Mandalorians, like, cool looking weapon that he has is some sort of like lethal tuning fork. It feels like it vibrates and then they vaporize. That seems to sort of like what we see there.
Yeah, it's not really like a blast that comes out of it, right?
Right.
It doesn't send a bolt. It just sort of makes you burst.
Yeah, it feels like a sonic sort of thing. And then, you know, if you're looking for Western references, this chase, where he's trying to get on their sand crawler, which is their vehicle, right? Is like a classic sort of train chase. And there's even a part where it's like a classic, the train's going through the tunnel moment, or Indiana Jones is stuck on the side of a Nazi tank.
That's what I was thinking of in The Last Crusade.
Yeah, the Valley of the Crescent Moon or something like that. So, you know, very familiar, setups for, an unfamiliar world. And, so we get all that. And then there's also like the visual of, Kuil as he's taking the Mandalorian to talk to the Jawas on like a blurg drawn carriage, basically. You know what I mean? It's just all very, like, very Western, is how these things look to me. So, and then there's some funny bits with the Mandalorian's bad, Jawa-ese or whatever. Yep, Jawa-ese. Wow. I guessed it. And that is what they speak. Jawa-ese. Like they're like, you sound like a Wookiee, and they're laughing at his bad, attempts to speak their language and stuff like that. It's pretty cute. And then we get this fight. We get this fight where he's fighting something, that we know is called a Mudhorn, which is not a creature that has existed in Star Wars before. There have been like rhinoceros-esque characters in Star Wars before, but this is a new one. It's very hairy. And it's got a very hairy egg, which is a little creepy.
My daughter said it looks like it's covered in ramen noodles. And I was like, it does.
Yeah, it's like mud and ramen noodles. But,
it has to be said, the Mudhorn, really, the horn, is, this thing must have serious neck problems as it gets older. Like the horn is just a lot. That's a lot. That's the horniest. Well, I probably shouldn't say that, but that is a creature with, that's like 90% horn. Like, I don't know how it walks or how it defies gravity to get around. And it beats the hell out of the Mandalorian with it.
Yeah, and his breastplate is like up by his ear. It's bad. And the only thing that saves him, is that Shamrock Shake coming through with the Force.
Yeah, so it's about to finish him off, and then all of a sudden it just sort of wriggles in the air, and it can't figure out what's going on. It can't get any traction in its muddy pit, and the little baby Yoda has paralyzed it. And then, with like one stab of his knife, the Mandalorian takes out this gross creature.
Well, everyone knows that you can kill a Mudhorn if you stab it behind its ear.
Right behind the ear. I guess so. I just thought.
Yeah. Something shot-wise that I really liked in this episode, they do it a couple times, is you get sort of Shamrock Shake POV. You get the cameras inside the space bassinet sort of zooming around, which I thought was a really clever idea. And, you know, as if we needed any more help being sympathetic to this adorable little creature. Here we are in its POV. So always pay attention to, where the camera is wanting you to feel like you are. And it wants us to be with this kid, as much as possible in this episode. And then the Force seems to like knock the kid out. It takes a snooze afterwards. Really tuckered that baby out. That show of Force. So, and it was an impressive show of Force. I mean, that was a huge creature. And it's just like immobilized, you know?
Yeah, that was interesting that it went into like a slumber, like a hibernation in a way.
Yeah,
having used the Force, and you know, I thought that had a little bit of significance for the new sequel trilogy, because do you remember in Rise of Skywalker, The Last Jedi, when Kylo and Rey are talking and they're having their Force communication, and Kylo says, "Who's doing this? It can't be you. The exertion of this would kill you, would kill a person." And then later, of course, we see Luke Skywalker project himself across the galaxy and then vanishes, seemingly depleted by the effort of having accomplished this great feat. And I thought that was a little bit of what we were seeing with Baby Yoda, is that lifting this rhino was not going to kill him, but whew, it's like working out, running a marathon.
Time
to have a bowl of spaghetti and take a big nap.
Well, and from a storytelling point of view, that's a really important thing to build in, because you can't, like, you want to have these little powerful displays of the Force, right? Because it's fun. But if the Mandalorian's traipsing around the galaxy with this thing that can, you know, is that powerful, that will make some of the scrapes I imagine he'll get into kind of boring, if he can just, like, oh, pull the trigger on the baby and get out of there, you know? So, like, if the baby's occasionally sleeping and can't help, then, you know what I mean? It's like sporadic flashes of the Force will make for interesting storytelling. Occasionally, maybe the Force will be helpful, but it can't be all Force all the time. Does that make sense? Because, like, that's a big question of introducing the Force into this show. We weren't sure if the Force would be a part of the show at all. I know when they were making Rogue One, initially they wanted to make Rogue One without the Force, and then they wound up putting Vader in and yada, yada, yada. But, like, initially they kind of wanted to explore telling Star Wars stories without the Force in it. And, that is not what they're doing here. The Force is definitely a part of it. But, like, you know what I mean about, it's like a Scarlet Witch in the Avengers, right? She's technically too powerful to fight any of the other Avengers. And so you have to sideline her occasionally, so that, you know, she can't just, like, mess with everyone's mind and that's the end of every single fight. You know what I mean? So, or the Vision, you know, so.
Yeah.
All right. So, okay. So that is what's going on in this episode. We get, the stuff back and we fly off. Just a couple more quick things before we go to our interview with Pedro. One is, do you think the presence of the Jawas and the fact that, Queel's farm kind of looks like it might be a moisture farm, or at least looks similar enough to the farm that Luke Skywalker grew up on, that there, it introduces the possibility that this could have taken place on Tatooine?
It doesn't feel like Tatooine to me.
Okay. It's the mud that disqualifies it from being Tatooine.
Mud there. I don't know. Just the texture. I think of Tatooine as being very sandy, and I don't know. Maybe. I mean, we've often noted that every planet has its own ecosystem. This doesn't feel like it, but a lot of the promo materials do show, like, a little Jawa transport and two twin suns and moisture farms, which definitely evokes Tatooine.
Right. And
I'm thinking maybe they go there later, but this didn't feel Tatooine-y to me.
Okay.
And I think if they had wanted to make that point, then they could have. But I don't know. I'm not sure. It's a no from me, dog.
Okay, fair enough. Please
reference brought to you by the year 2002.
And, like, Coca-Cola. I don't know what is sponsoring our podcast. And then the last question, I don't know this about you, Anthony. Are you a Doctor Who fan?
I'm not, partly because I've never found the entry point. You know, we were talking about you've got to find a time to jump aboard the train, and it's got to be accessible. And, I know everybody loves it. I'm sorry to report, I'm not a huge Doctor Who. I'm not familiar with Doctor Who. Doctor Who for me actually has a question mark at the end of it.
Doctor Who? This moment at the end of the episode, when the Mandalorian turns to Queel and is like, you know, you could come with me if you wanted to. I wouldn't mind that, basically. And he's like, no, I live here. Thanks so much. It reminded me a lot of the Doctor and Doctor Who. The Doctor is this, like, incredibly, you know, impressive, adventurous figure, but fundamentally incredibly lonely, and is, you know, the supporting characters in any season of Doctor Who are called companions, because he goes around the galaxy and he pulls these, like, human companions on board his ship with them and goes off and does these adventures. But his profound loneliness, As a man with no planet, which is similar to the Mandalorian, a man with no planet, is part of the driving force of the story. And so I just had a moment when he like asked this creature who he just met to come with him. It was just sort of like, this is a lonely guy. This is a lonely, lonely guy. And perhaps, you know, that's, you know, maybe the Shamrock Shake will be able to fill that little, bat wing shaped hole in his heart or something like that. But, I don't know. Do you have any thoughts about that moment in particular?
The moment of what? Like the bonding between them or what would you?
Well, him asking Kuiil to come with him.
Oh, asking him to come with him. Yeah, I mean, look, he was handy, right? It's dangerous to go alone. And I think, I also think the Mandalorian doesn't fully trust his feelings about this child, you know? And I think it's sort of like, what should I do here? He needs a Jiminy Cricket.
Yeah.
And Kuiil seems like a man of integrity or an Ugnaught of integrity. You know, when he says, I have spoken, he's very definitive. And I think the Mandalorian would like some of that certainty in his life. So yeah, I think, I do get the sense that he'd like a crew. He'd like a gang.
Yeah, I think, you know, and that's, I mean, I'm sure that that's also a theme of like the lone gunslingers, in Westerns as well. But just this idea of like, someone who appears stoic, appears to not really need people that much or whatever, but then you get these flashes of vulnerability or the weight of their solitude, in what they do. So, maybe we can find a friend for the Mandalorian. I wouldn't mind it. Gina Carano is in the cast. Maybe she can be his friend. We'll see. Should we go now to, your conversation with Pedro Pascal?
Yeah, let's go to it.
Let's do it.
We've all been there before. You're planning a dinner party or having family over or even just cooking for yourself when all of a sudden it starts to feel overwhelming.
I live in a very small one-bedroom apartment with a very small kitchen.
I can't figure out what to serve besides water soup at this point.
I'm Chris Morocco, food director of Bon Appetit and Epicurious, and this is Dinner SOS, a new podcast from Bon Appetit. Maybe it's a last-minute party with no menu inspiration, a kitchen with no space, a toddler who will only eat buttered pasta. Name your dinner emergency. We're here to help. Here's how the show works. On each episode, we'll take a call from a home cook facing a real dinner emergency. Then, I'll work with one of our editors or someone from our amazing test kitchen to try and solve it. Because cooking for the people you love should inspire joy without a side of stress. Make sure you're following Dinner SOS wherever you're listening now.
Apple Card is the perfect cash back rewards credit card. You can earn up to 3% daily cash on every purchase every day. That's 3% on your favorite products at Apple, 2% on all other Apple Card with Apple Pay purchases, and 1% on anything you buy with your titanium Apple Card or virtual card number. Visit apple.co/card calculator to see how much you can earn. Apple Card issued by Goldman Sachs Bank USA, Salt Lake City branch. Subject to credit approval. Terms apply.
So the first thing I want to ask you, I know you've been asked a lot about how you portray emotion when you're playing a masked character, but I want to talk about the voice because I think that voice, it conjures Clint Eastwood and the whispered, raspy voice he had in a lot of those early Sergio Leone Westerns. I know that was an influence for Dave Filoni and Jon Favreau. Was he an influence for you too in your performance?
Oh yeah. The first thing that they told me to study were, Akira Kurosawa samurai films and then Sergio Leone's, spaghetti westerns. And they very specifically built this character on those old iconic loners. It's been a really interesting improvisation in terms of like figuring out what his posture is, how he moves, how he walks, how he
communicates how he makes a point and how the voice like exists under the mask. And it's very detail oriented. And I can get a little compulsive about details. And they've kind of created the perfect opportunity for me to work some of those things out, because once we capture the body language on camera, and obviously the voice being specifically connected to that body language, but then we can fine tune it, we can change it, we can in post. I mean, it's a visual effects show. It's an effect. I'm sorry. It's not a strictly a visual effects show. It's an effects show. And as far as I'm concerned, the stars of it are all of the different art departments, that go into it, sound being one of them. And so I guess my contribution feels like a fraction of, you know, or just one component out of many that create the character and the world that he is moving through.
Let's talk about that costume then. Mm-hmm. Well, again, with Eastwood, just, I know this is the Mandalorian armor we've known since we saw Boba Fett in the original trilogy, mm-hmm. Yeah. But that slit of the eyes, yeah. It looks like narrowed eyes. It looks like a squint, doesn't
yeah.
it?
Yeah. It's like the ultimate poker face, you know? The way that it looks, just, you know, watching playback of something that we just shot, and the, you know, the language that the design of the costume makes and the way that it's lit, you know, because so much of the armor is reflective of light, is crazy. And they keep on insisting that it isn't just anybody that can make it look as good as it does, but I don't believe them yet.
How much of your physicality is dictated by the costume, by the weight of it, by the boots, by the armor you're wearing on your body? Like, how much, sometimes restriction is good and it gives you, helps you find a character.
I would say only about 100%. Uh-huh. You know, it's all about like weight distribution and using the design of the costume to, share the character. I'm not going to lie, it's really strange, but not altogether new. It's about like reintroducing myself to all of that, all the things that I learned in class and on stage. I remember doing, Commedia dell'arte and, an entire portion of this one play where, you know, I had to do it in a mask and in very, very animated and exaggerated way, you know, use the body to tell the story. And, this is very much like that, but in the opposite tone of like economical movements.
I was going to say, I think you work very eloquently with stillness as mm-hmm. the Mandalorian.
Yeah.
What
yeah.
role does stillness play in depicting his character?
Well, that's the thing, is that like you kind of figure out a posture and commit.
Are you actively thinking like, don't move too much, don't subconsciously
oh, yeah.
be moving your hands, but like actually find a position where you go to a bar and stand there and they're taunting you.
Mm-hmm.
Is it in your mind consciously like to think about every single small movement? Because a lot of us, we're talking, we're moving, and we move in all sorts of ways that we don't really think about. But it sounds like that was something you had to keep in mind as you were rolling camera.
That's like the dominant thing about it, really, is figuring all of those details out. And all of the tricks or habits, really, that you develop. The way that you hold your head or fidgets don't really work with this character. So you have to be hyper vigilant, about that stuff. It's exhausting.
I want to hear about working with some of these actors. Let's start with Carl Weathers, who is a larger than life character in his own way.
Yeah.
But the relationship between the Mandalorian and Greef Karga is something that reminds me of, Greef seems to be looking out for him, but he also seems to be manipulating him in some ways. And I feel like the Mandalorian knows that he's being guided or manipulated. He knows not to trust him. But how would you describe the relationship between those two? And what was it like working with Carl?
Well, the whole world that we're in, with the Mandalorian is so kind of unpredictable. And, Greef Karga, Carl's character, is our best example of not knowing what to expect, and not knowing whether or not you can trust a thing. So it's a very kind of classic dynamic and relationship, and he is an actor that exudes a presence with also very, very economical efforts, you know? He just has an incredible face. And he also knows how to utilize stillness and intimidate and also surprise you with, like, empathy and humanity, and he's just a great looking dude. You know what I mean? Like, he's beautiful to watch. And he has such a, he's a pro. It's a charisma, but it's also like a skill and a professionalism. You can see how, how hard he is on himself as well. You know what I mean? Like, he definitely won't allow anything to be, not at its full potential. And it's inspiring, to be around.
How about your scenes with Gina? She's in, not the first few episodes of the series, but later when he comes to encounter her, but she's tough. Cara Dune is a veteran of the Galactic Civil War. She's been through some things. She was a shock trooper. They're both tough customers. What were some of your experiences like shooting with her?
Well, Gina Carano is the kind of person that, like, I wish I'd known her my whole life. And I'm so glad to know her now. Because she is capable of being physically intimidating and also seductive, mysterious, and also very warm. And the effortlessness that of which she is able to, like, you know, provide that, all of those different things, is pretty amazing. She's just a really, really nice person.
But she's strong, man. You're in a fight sequence with her.
That's why she doesn't need to,
so she doesn't have to be mean and personality wise, cause she's,
this, as strong as she is as nice as she is. She's been a huge, part of like, really initiating all of us into the first floor of this experience, you know? She's been kind of like the heart of the show. And that makes sense for her character, but it's also a very, like, symbiotic relationship between, like, who she is and who she's playing and centering all of us into the heart of what we're doing.
So the things that you are able to portray or convey to the audience through stillness, and economic movements, like, it seems like those are often more like are intimidating emotions, you know, that he's coiled, that he's, you know, ready to strike. You're also called upon to show some tenderness as this character. How, how difficult is that to portray without the use of subtle facial features?
You can believe it as much as you want, and then the challenge is figuring out how to tell that story.
Show.
Yeah, how to show it. And I think that very little goes a long way. Somebody who never lets their guard down, and then it can become all about like discovering what is the smallest gesture of letting his guard down for the first time, in front of another character or another creature, or developing, you know, a relationship, in the show, and how his body language basically gradually, you know, starts to, let its guard down. So I wouldn't say I have that figured out at all, but it's constantly being like discovered and developed.
And are you in consultation with your director? Like, well, there's going to be a music cue here that also will help carry some of that load for you. Or visually, here's how we're constructing it.
Sometimes that can be like the answer to some questions that I have, and they'll kind of clue me into, oh, well, you know, I'll be sweeping in here. I'll be like, you know, I'm moving towards you here, and then this music's going to creep in. So don't worry about not knowing how to like convey this moment. You know what I mean? There are so many technical factors that are going to achieve like the emotional tone of it. Which is hard for me to let go of, you know, it's also, and so then I kind of very privately anchor myself to the story without, you know, it necessarily, living past the mask, and then just hope that whatever uncontrolled thing that I can contribute is captured, you know, and getting that, you know, and finding those spontaneous moments.
The look of the character, obviously he's a new character. Dave and John have said over and over, he's not Boba Fett, but a lot of people will look at that mask, that helmet, they'll see the cape, and that's how we were first introduced to Mandalorians, mm-hmm. was through Boba Fett. I'm sure that's how I grew up.
Oh, yeah,
and what you grew up like. Tell me about the significance of that image. In your mind, personally speaking, as somebody who was a Star Wars fan when he was young?
Well, it was a toy that I had when I was a kid. It was like my favorite Star Wars action figure. Him and a green-headed anteater looking, a creature with a brown robe.
Would that have been Greedo?
Greedo. It would have had to have been from episodes. Shot? Yes.
Yeah.
Exactly. The one that Han Solo shot.
Greedo
in the bar. Mm-hmm. That's right. And so as a child, these characters did not stand out for me in having seen the movies, but the toys did. They were the toys that I fell in love with and utilized the most.
In your own storytelling, right? Mm-hmm. That's what kids mm-hmm. do is they yeah. use those characters to tell their own
yeah,
story.
Yeah, exactly. And so to, you know, put on a costume that harkens to my experience to one of my favorite toys is really weird.
It conjures those emotions of those good times.
Absolutely.
Right? The birthday or the Christmas or whatever when absolutely. You got the toy.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's what I think is
very strangely nostalgic and it activates a very funny, bone in the imagination, you know?
But it's different. Did they talk about that with you very much? Taking something that looks familiar, but actually making it something
yeah.
that's different. Why is that? What alchemy does that create in?
Well, they're breaking new territory. They're taking such a familiar world and starting to kind of discover new things, almost at the point where you feel like there isn't anything else to discover. And that's what I'm just kind of amazed by. I don't know what the answer is in terms of like how to do that, but I can tell you that the opportunity is being provided to discover it anew on a daily basis. And that's pretty crazy. It's challenging because you want answers or you want to know what to anchor yourself to. But really what you have to anchor yourself to is just like being present in this collaborative experience of a whole new, like, chapter in Star Wars.
Yeah. I think it's a fascinating combination because you want originality, but you're also getting nostalgia.
Yeah.
It's very hard to bring those two together.
They're writing such a fine line between both, between the old and the new. And those are our kind of like selling points, you know, in our paper of talking points, you know what I mean? Talk about the old and the new. And it's easy to do that because it's really what they're doing. Sometimes I wish some of it was a little more new, to be honest with you, because it is so physically challenging to capture that level of quality. John is a freak. He was just the other day noticing that my boots didn't have the appropriate level of frost. and then after like a long conversation, and I couldn't help through my own exhaustion just think to myself, you know, now you're just going crazy. You know, I kept that thought to myself, which I'll now share with the world. And then I walk into my dressing room and the boots had been worked on and they looked exactly like what my boots would have looked like after walking through a blizzard in New York City. And I had to take a picture and send it to him and be like, you might actually be a genius because it's the buildup of all of those details in a world like this, where like no stone is no stone is
unturned.
And, you know, the collection of all of that into this kind of storytelling is what is really going to satisfy audiences, I think. Yeah.
Well, thank you so much, Pedro Pascal, for talking to us.
Oh, you're very welcome. It's my pleasure.
All right. That is it for this episode of Still Watching the Mandalorian. Anthony, until we are back with Chapter 3, where can people find you on the internet?
You can find me at Bresnikan on Twitter and on the website of vanityfair.com.
You can find me on vanityfair.com as well. You can find me on Twitter at Joe Wrote This. And once again, if you want to email us anything, you can email us stillwatchingpod@gmail.com. We love getting your emails. We love reading them on air. And until then, until next week, I guess we'll see you out in the galaxy. I don't know. We need a catchphrase. I'll think of one. Bye.
Bye. That's our catchphrase. Bye.
I'm Alex Schwartz.
I'm Nomi Fry.
I'm Vincent Cunningham, and this is Critics at Large, a New Yorker podcast for the culturally curious.
Each week, we're going to talk about a big idea that's showing up across the cultural landscape, and we'll trace it through all the mediums we love. Books, movies, television, music, art.
And I always want to talk about celebrity gossip, too.
Of course.
What are you guys excited to cover in the next few months?
There's a new translation of the Iliad that's coming out, Emily Wilson. Oh. Really excited to see whether I can read the Iliad again, whether I'm that literate. The jury is out.
I can't wait to hear Adam Driver go again in an Italian accent in Michael Mann's Ferrari.
He can't stop.
I mean, and bless him. I can't wait.
Molto bene.
Molto bene.
We hope you'll join us for new episodes each Thursday. Follow Critics at Large today, wherever you get podcasts.
You really don't want to miss this.
Don't.
Don't miss this.
Don't miss it.
See you soon.
From PRX.